certainly for his many books, a few of which I mentioned, and I do say a few. Usually that's a lie. In this case, alas, it's not. Social epistemology, the governance of science, and of course, especially important here in Boston, Thomas Kuhn, A Philosophical History for Our Times. He also has a new book which is just out from Columbia University Press, which is Kuhn versus Popper, The Struggle for the Soul of Science, which I have done without the microphone, so I hope you've heard me. But Steve.
I don't think I'm going to need a microphone. No. Okay. First of all, I want to thank Babette for inviting me to participate in this symposium on the science wars. I guess they're just not quite over yet. I was a little surprised that this topic is still being discussed, but from Ron's talk, we realize there's still a lot to learn here. Let me begin by sort of positioning myself with respect to where Ron is coming from. I think there's a sense in which the kinds of views that Ron has been promoting about science as being practice-based and how we have to be very much sensitive to disciplinary differences among the sciences in order to understand science properly, I think it's fair to say, and this is by way of a compliment, that Ron has been doing this for about 20 years now, and in a sense predates the science wars, and he's always been very much a fellow traveler with developments in science studies. Now, it seems to me that the status of those kinds of views that Ron is representing, and which I think came out in Joe Rouse's remarks, are close to the mainstream of what science studies is doing now. It seems to me that the import of those views has shifted over the past 20 years. So what 20 years ago would have been seen as a kind of critique and a deserved and long overdue critique of the excesses of a highly formalist approach to the philosophy of science that just focused on formalized theories and ignored the rest and was overly physics-based and all that, nowadays it's become kind of almost a sort of an establishment view. And this is where I'm coming from here. So there's a sense in which the import of the view has shifted, and it may for some people in this room this seems to be a very radical view, but for me it seems to be an increasingly kind of conservative, traditional sort of view that raises a lot of problems with regard to issues having to do with the future of science. Now, when I presented my abstract to Babette, the title of the talk was "Nobody Here But Us Science Lovers." Okay, and it's and this is kind of a point that I think is very important to bring up here. Because one thing that hasn't been stressed enough in the discussions of the science wars is no matter what side you're on, you're pro-science, right? And this is not a battle, you know, between, let's say, scientists and philosophers of science against people who hate science or think of themselves as irrationalist or something like that. Rather, these are, in fact, people, all of whom think they can draw on the authority of science. Right, and if you look at books like Sokol and Brinkmann's Fashionable Nonsense and so forth, right, there's a sense in which the complaint is these people, as it were, are running before they can walk. They're over-enthusiastic about their appropriation of science for purposes of justifying various kinds of philosophical, cultural, political claims. And that's a very interesting feature about this. And it reflects a fact about our time, namely that science has become a very contested notion. Right, and it's become a very contested notion to such an extent that I think one of the questions that the science wars puts on the table is whether there's any coherent concept of science worth defending here. Okay, because as you go down the track, and here I think of philosophers and sociologists very much kind of thinking similarly in this regard, once you go down the track of saying, well, you know, there are many different sciences, they each have their own structure, some of them are very theoretically integrated, others are not, we have different kinds of practices that pass as scientific, there are various local standards, then, it seems to me that from where Ron's coming from, that's a kind of congenial view. One can then take it a step further and say different communities, different cultures have their own forms of knowledge and so forth. You can sort of diversify it even more. And you could say, well, you don't have to have a unified ontology in order to do science. You can keep on, pushing things down that road. And then at the end of the day, you end up saying, well, we have a vast array of heterogeneous practices that we all call science. Well, what makes them science? Why are we still using this term? If we are going to go down that route, right, what is it that we're defending here? And I think one of the things, of course, that you see that is a kind of a sign that this has already taken place, is the general decline of, well, the decline of the general philosophy of science. Right, so the kinds of issues that, let's say, were of concern to the logical positivists, or Popper, or even Thomas Kuhn, and Lakatos, and Loudon, and all these kinds of people, this stuff is just taught to undergraduates now. Right, it's the made-for-export side of philosophy of science, and it's not really the cutting-edge stuff as defined by the professionals in the field. Okay, in a way, it has kind of the same status as, let's say, in sociology of science, when we want to do made-for-export sociology of science, we teach Robert Merton's Four Norms. Right? And that's often how philosophers end up learning about the sociology of science. But the point is, that is not to be confused with what people who think of themselves as cutting-edge sociologists of science are doing, some of the stuff to which Joe Rouse was alluding to in his remarks. So there's a sense in which, so this idea of there being a general field called philosophy of science as a kind of, you know, that no matter which discipline you're interested in, it somehow sort of feeds back into a general problem of progress, or general problem of rationality, or general problem of objectivity. All of these things, it seems to me, have become seen as sort of old-fashioned or not really relevant anymore, and in a sense, you can't really deal with these kinds of problems at the general level they have been dealt with in the past. Okay, and so under criticism here aren't just the formalists, but also a lot of the historicists as well, of the Loudon, Kuhn, Lakatos variety. Okay, so in a sense, the whole business of having to have a philosophy of science that has science as the subject matter in some as-such way is disappearing. Another sign of this, of course, is the disappearance of the demarcation problem, again, except for the made-for-export market. Right? So when you worry about creationists, you bring in demarcation. But nobody, again, there isn't a lot of development of this kind of thing as a serious philosophical issue. And in fact, most contemporary philosophers of science probably think the demarcation problem is just a kind of quick fix. Substitute for where the real philosophy ought to be happening. And one can continue going along and watching how things disappear. So even within sociology of science now, we don't really like to call the field sociology of science. We like to talk about it as a sociology of techno-science, where techno-science is understood to be this kind of amalgam, right, of science and technology that forms the infrastructure of contemporary life. Right? And so there's no particular interest in, let's say, trying to figure out what scientists are doing for their own sake. One is interested in how this fits into a sort of larger network and, you know, assembly or whatever, you know, various metaphors get used to capture this kind of process. So again, science is kind of disappearing from view here. And science often ends up becoming just sort of a loose way of talking about how you get action in the world. Right? It's a certain kind of way of organizing people and things to get action in some kind of substantial way. Of course, even if we look at history, which in a way tends to be the least of the ideologically committed fields of science studies, there is a tendency, I think, there to try to eliminate or, again, marginalize the concept of a scientific revolution. Because, again, from a historical standpoint, one of the ways in which science is well defined is supposedly that there was a scientific revolution in the 17th century, let's say, that somehow brought about a certain way of understanding the world that, let's say, was either previously not there or wasn't as important as it turned out to be subsequently. So a lot of the historical work in the past had focused on this. But now, through work people like Stephen Chapin and lots of others, right, we are now being told scientific revolution didn't really happen, that this is, in a sense, again, another kind of crass coarse word for a lot of various kinds of developments where you can't really strictly separate the science from anything else going on in the society. Okay? So all of these developments that we're seeing happening now and are very much being taken forward by the younger generation of people is kind of causing the concept of science to kind of sort of fade from view as a kind of object of inquiry in its own right, and it's blending into many other kinds of fields and many other kinds of areas. And in a sense, all of the concern about relativizing science is just kind of the tip of the iceberg. This thing is just happening even among people who would normally call themselves realists. I mean, Ron calls himself a realist. Right, right, exactly. Look at what happens, right? This is an example of what we're talking about here, right? But everything has gotten very attenuated here, and it's quite interesting, right? It's an interesting sort of feature. So we get back to this issue about the science wars. What are we arguing about here in the science wars? Why is everybody so upset about who goes around using the word science to justify what they're saying? What is at stake? Now, people like Sokol and Brinkman, who have very sort of crude philosophical views, right, tend to operate with a sledgehammer. But there does seem to be a general problem that they're pointing to here, the ease with which this term science can be appropriated and used, and where does one draw the line, and why would one want to draw the line, right? Interestingly, it seems to me, from my own standpoint, the science wars have been a kind of good thing insofar as they have raised to public consciousness this kind of, as it were, crisis of science. Namely, what is the point of calling something science, of wanting to promote a certain kind of activity as science, right? To promote it as science as opposed to, let's say, promoting it as part of research and development? To promote it as science, you know, as opposed to building the national infrastructure, right? I mean, why do we want to promote it as science? And it seems to me this is kind of an issue that, in a way, in the science wars do not get dealt with very effectively, I think, because the wars have been conducted very much in the kind of classical language of epistemology and philosophy of science, where the only kind of end that's ever discussed in any detail is truth, and basically everything else has to do with whether one is following appropriate methods or, as it were, can match up to a certain kind of exemplar of what is taken to be science. So the debate doesn't get very far because there isn't really an open discussion about what is the point of wanting to pursue science in the first place as a distinct, unique activity, as opposed to, let's say, part of building the economy, part of building the military, or whatever. Okay, and it seems to me that kind of issue is a very important one. And in a way, it's sort of hovering behind the science wars, but never gets expressed openly. And one of the things that in a way, to kind of anticipate the point I end up at is that in a way the site for pursuing science as such and all the disciplines that would normally think of themselves under this rubric has been the university and has presupposed kind of the university's integrity as a kind of site. So, you know, when Sokol and Brinkman are having arguments with the sociologists and all the other people in science studies, there's a presupposition here that there's some kind of common space being contested, and of course one needs to ask not just what the conceptual space is, but what's the institutional space where this debate matters, right? And it has to do, of course, with the university and the future of the university. Because in a certain sense, if one has a very free market attitude about the way knowledge is being produced, right, in a sense you could say, look, everybody can have their own concept of science, and you know, if you can get people to support it, God bless you. Right? If the creationists can have their institutes in Baylor University, fine. You know, if you want to do things the old-fashioned way, fine. If you want to do some funky new science, fine. Why do we have to worry? You know, why do we have to have a debate about whether any of these things are science, right? Where does this debate matter? And it matters, obviously, at the university, especially in designing curriculum and things like this, and how you want to train people. Okay, and so I go back to the initial point I was making about how all of this general philosophy of science and general sociology of science is part of the made-for-export market, which happens at the undergraduate level. And it seems to me this is kind of a very important site for this kind of discussion, because in a sense, this is the point at which people are being taught about science as a kind of form of social authority. Right? You know, in other words, you know, we're interested in teaching about science, not necessarily because we expect you're going to become a scientist, because in that case, you ought to take some real science courses, right? But rather because there's a kind of authority to science in the society that we think is worth promoting. What exactly the nature of that authority is varies depending on what course you're taking, but the point is that that's kind of an important issue, that it somehow matters in terms of the way in which society is legitimated or something of that kind, and that's why it should be part of general citizen education. And it seems to me that's where that made-for-export market belongs, and I think that's a very important kind of question still to be asking today and to be addressing, okay? But it's not necessarily considered to be a very sexy topic from the standpoint of those who see themselves as being on the cutting edge, okay? So there's a sense in which this is a kind of important issue at stake here that gets kind of lost. Now, my own way, you know, as I've been sort of involved in the science wars in a way, sort of as a participant and sort of as a commentator, and all of this has been happening during the period when I've been sort of writing about Thomas Kuhn and all the various things surrounding him, it seems to me that it becomes very important to sort of look at this from a historical standpoint. Because, you know, as I said at the very beginning, there's a sense in which a view that looks very progressive, let's say 20 years ago, because of the sort of things it was opposing, might not look so progressive later on. And I think very often with views in the philosophy and sociology of science, the background context becomes very important, the background socio and political context in which science is being discussed. So in the abstract that I submitted, one of the things that I brought out, which as a kind of precedent for the sort of time that we're living in, in other words, if you're looking for a kind of model for understanding the situation where we are in this kind of crisis of authority about science that I'm talking about, where would you go? It seems to me after World War I would be the time to go, the Weimar period, which is like our period in many respects, it seems to me. And often I think, first of all, you've got a period where science had been very heavily involved in the military effort, especially with Germany, where the German scientific community was very explicitly on the side of the Kaiser, led to major humiliating defeat, and so there is a reaction against that, okay? And a reaction in particular against the kinds of sciences that were seen as being in the forefront of the war effort, so the physics, determinism in physics and chemistry in particular, there is a lot of reaction against that. Moreover, you start to get a lot of skepticism about the concept of progress. I think this is a very important point here, because the whole business about talking about the history of progress, the name of a very famous book by J.B. Bury, which came out in 1918-1919, and often seen as kind of landmark study of the subject, the reason why he wrote this book was because he thought the concept had come to an end, right? So now you can do the history of it, right? Olive Minerva style. And so the thing is, what was that about progress? Now we fought World War I and we realized that in fact science is incredibly destructive, right? Causes all kinds of problems. We've got to rethink what had gone wrong there, okay? And that was a very widely held view, especially in Europe. Not so much in the United States. In fact, because the United States was sort of at a distance with regard to World War I, in a sense, this kind of progressive view about science sort of stayed there, John Dewey being a kind of an exemplar. And one of the things that you start to see, because when science was seen as this kind of motor of progress prior to the end of World War I, it was very closely connected with technology, right, and chemistry being kind of the foremost science. And when Germans were making the claim that, we are the most scientific progressive country in the world, therefore we will win the war, right, it was the close connection with technology that was being imagined here. And in fact, the history of the idea of progress that Bury tells is one in which, in fact, those two things are very closely bound together. Okay? What you start to get after World War I is that people begin to realize, and I think here of the logical positivists primarily, and Popper as well, people in that ilk begin to realize we're in a situation where the baby's being thrown out with the bathwater here, right, where there's an enormous amount of skepticism about progress. It's tied very much to the involvement of science and technological developments that turned out to be incredibly horrendous and bad, and so people now are blaming it on the very basic ideas and on the theories and all the rest of it, and turning back the clock in a very substantial way. So in some sense, we have got to preserve what is good about science during what they sort of imagine to be kind of a dark era that we're entering into in the Weimar period, right, where things like astrology is being publicly funded, right, where there is, of course, you have the great efflorescence of hybrid sciences like psychoanalysis taking place. And there, what is it that needs to be preserved, right? What is it that needs to be preserved? And the strategy, of course, of the logical positivists was very much to draw a very sharp line between science and technology in a way it hadn't been done really up to that point, even among people who called themselves positivists, especially perhaps among people who called themselves positivists. And in fact, the sharp line was very much done on the model of how mathematics in the 19th century had managed to extricate itself from just being kind of the measuring discipline of physics. Right, because this idea of mathematics is an autonomous discipline with its own set of problems that are closed under its own laws, this was something that actually, recovering that Euclidean heritage was something that took place over the course of the 19th century. Because if you look at how mathematics was thought about in the Enlightenment, it was much more practical, instrumental kind of subject. So the logical positivists, from that standpoint, you could see them as trying to recover what is important and what is good about science as being the kind of beacon of reason and so forth, from it being sort of submerged with all the bad technological consequences that took place. And so you start to get these very sharp splits that then become characteristic of professional philosophy of science in the 20th century, right? Moreover, not only does it become part of the professional structure of philosophy of science, but after World War II, right, when you have a kind of more positive view towards science on the part of the winning party in the United States, and positivists are the sort of the official philosophy of science, this gets turned into a kind of science policy, what science policy people call the linear model, whereby the best way to get the maximum benefit from science is by funding a lot of basic research up front. Because you first need the theory, you first need that to be tested and proven and all the rest of it, and then once you've done that, you can start applying it to things. And this is in fact an aspect, a kind of this two-stage aspect, is something that is in fact common to the logical positivist and to Kuhn. Because Kuhn, if you look at the way in which Kuhn talks about progress in science, it has nothing to do with technological application. The only technology that matters is the technology you need to do your experiments to be solving your problems, but not the larger sense of technology. Okay. And so this ends up becoming very much part of the science policy mentality. And the science policy mentality that protects science in a way and shields it off from the technological consequences is happening during a period of the Cold War where there's a lot of concern about national security. And so then this then gets sort of folded into an idea of there being kind of a unified form of knowledge. And all these sciences have to be on our side. They have to be organized in some way. And we need to figure out who the experts are who can make the judgments about them for purposes of funding and so forth. And they are and they have a kind of natural structure to it. And they all, as it were, are all sciences in the same sense. And this then becomes kind of the dominant, you might say, meta-paradigm of the way in which science policy occurs during the Cold War period. And and what was keeping it going was the national security concern. Right, so there's a sense in which there's a monopoly of the funding coming from the state, and it's all very much organized, very centralized. It's easy to think about science as being in some sense unified in that way, because from terms of funding streams, it was getting that way in a way it hadn't been before. And so from that standpoint, the logical positivist picture actually had a certain kind of practical kind of resonance. Okay, Cold War comes to an end. Issues of, at least until 9/11, we'll see what happens in the long term there, but after the Cold War ends, this issue about national security kind of begins to fade, science budgets become very sort of seen as overblown, there's a kind of you start to see the paradigm shift taking place from physics to biology as being the primary science, and that reflects a very important sea change here, it seems to me, because when physics was physics as the sort of fundamental science, the thing that we all share, that's going to be responsible for either keeping us going or blowing ourselves up with the atomic bomb. That fades to a completely different notion of science, which the biological sciences exemplify much better, which is one that is more constituency and client-based, where you're imagining there's a kind of diverse market, diverse audience for science. There's no reason why you think it all has to come from one place and be subject to just one set of standards. There isn't something that's threatening everyone together in the way it had been in the past. So now one can think about every science, as it were, having to prove itself to whatever constituencies and clientele it wants. And it's in that environment, right, that we start to see biology really taking off, and with it a kind of meta-theory comes into play whereby unity doesn't matter anymore. Unity is superfluous because biology survives perfectly well without it. We can look at the different environments in which this research in biology is being pursued, and it all has their own independent trajectories and practices. And as long as there are reasons for promoting that, we just keep them going. And one can, as it were, do a natural history of this and show how these developments occur, but there is no sense of closure or unity that one necessarily wants to be going after here. And this is kind of the state of play now, it seems to me. And of course, as we've shifted generations, we move from those older people who were actually trained by the logical positivists and kind of remember what the unity of science movement was around, and we get the new generation of people who start with the blank slate, as it were, on this. The whole physics mania looks beside the point. How could these people have ever thought that physics was the most important science? It is, you know, sure, it was prestigious and all the rest of it, and they did some amazing things, but it's so uncharacteristic, right, of what sciences do, okay? And that argument seems now very commonsensical, very taken for granted by the younger generation, right? And so what do we see philosophers of physics doing? Basically giving the ancestors a dutiful burial. So we see the Michael Friedmans, the Nancy Cartwrights, people start writing history. In philosophy, that's always a dangerous sign, right? Because that sort of means then that, as it were, the frontline action is over, and now what we have to do is kind of reinterpret the past to make sure that, you know, we manage to sort of show that, in fact, let's say the logical positivists weren't all that concerned with unity. In fact, they had a much more unified view of things. So they look like the people who we still want to claim as our ancestors leading up to the present and the future that we project ourselves going into. So all of this kind of what we call it historical revisionism taking place at the moment about the logical positivist is very interesting because it makes them more in sync with the kind of biology-centered sort of view that we're living in now. And often a lot of very clever, ingenious sorts of hermeneutics that need to be done on this, including missing out on a lot of other people, right? But it's very telling. So this kind of trajectory is going on here. And so from that standpoint, you see the debates between, let's say, philosophers of science and sociologists of science are really quite, they're kind of just the tip of the iceberg, and they don't really matter that much, because from the standpoint of the way things had been in the past with a sort of unified view of science, they're both already singing from the same hymn sheet. The issue is going to be, what is exactly relativized here? Are we talking about, different disciplines, that each of which have their own local ontologies? Is that just a politically correct way of talking about there being different scientific cultures, the way sociologists like to talk about it? Is there really that much difference between these two viewpoints when it gets down to it, other than, as it were, at the level of rhetoric, where the words, as it were, resonate with different sorts of traditions and different sorts of implications? I mean, one of the things that's very striking about when philosophers and sociologists of science get into these kinds of debates in the science wars is that very quickly, if the debate gets heated, it moves away from talking about the examples, right, of the actual sciences, where there's pretty much could be agreement on, and immediately get to the sort of, three-line reputation of the village relativist. Right, immediately sort of shifts the ground very quickly to get to a very sort of stereotyped view of the position that nobody holds. Okay, because in a sense, that's where they sort of think, that's where they think the battle's happening. But one would like to step back and say, look, that's just an issue of words here. And this is why science studies in particular has been a field that, in a sense, is constantly reinventing its language. Because as soon as somebody tries to nail them on being social this or constructivist that, they'll say, well, no, wait a minute, now we're getting into debates we won't be into. And I think if you actually follow that logic all along, first of all, you'll sort of, as it were, launder your language of all the things that in the past have made science worth fighting for. That'll be the first thing that'll happen, right? And second of all, you'll find out that actually, the philosophers and sociologists aren't really that far apart from each other these days, the contemporary ones. They have different ways of talking about it, but they're kind of interested in the same sorts of things and actually value the same kinds of skills that one needs to have, so that one needs, as it were, to do philosophy of science to know something about the science. Does one have to do an ethnography? No, maybe take a course, right? I mean, the thing is, what's the difference between these two things when it gets right down to it? What they both have in common is it's a sea change from the older view, whereby there was, as it were, a kind of philosophically privileged position from which one could talk about the nature of science, on the basis of which one could criticize very substantially ongoing scientific practices. So that even something like the demarcation criterion, right, which is still an old chestnut that survives in a way, it's conducted in a totally different way now, right? Basically, when you see it, especially with the debates over creationism, where it gets wheeled out a lot against intelligent design theory and so forth, what you see are that the philosophers are less relying. See, when Popper and the positivists did this demarcation stuff, they were relying on criteria about the nature of science that were drawn from the best examples of science and abstracted from that. And there was really no concern about whether that was particularly representative of how all science actually goes. So people like Popper were constantly attacking, the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, evolutionary theory, right? Popper, it was fair game. All these things came under the Popperian axe, all these things, right? Which from this standpoint of today just seems scandalous, disrespectful, but nevertheless, very, very much quintessentially philosophical what he was doing, where there was a sort of separate standard, and it was based on the best cases and then judge against the best cases. Nowadays, things are a bit different. One, as it were, does the demarcation problem as a kind of underlaborer for the science whose honor one is defending. So, for example, defending evolutionary theory, right? We sort of take that as true. We take that as basically true or on the right track. And then on the basis of that, we then judge the competitors. We don't have an independent standard of our own about what we think good science is necessarily. No, we have what we are endorsing, and then we use that as the standard against which to deal with the outliers. Okay, and that's a fundamentally different kind of use of the demarcation criteria, because the philosopher no longer has any independent normative authority. The philosopher's normative authority in these cases are completely parasitic on the science they happen to be supporting. Okay? And if it turns out that tomorrow, let's say, evolutionary theory disappears or gets replaced by something radically different, the philosophers will have to do that too. Right? At least that's the way it seems to be the logic of the way philosophy of science is going. If there are radical sea changes in the way in which science is being practiced that is decided by the scientific practitioners, right, in some, a fashion that they regard as self-recognizing and self-approving, then the philosophers have to change their view about what science is too. And that's the situation I think that we're in today. The sociologists, by the way, are in the same situation with regard to the sociology of science. This is a real big shift. And I think that there is something very much lost here, okay? And to just, how much time do you reckon I have here? Just so we don't, about 10 minutes left? Yeah, okay.
Max.
All right, Max. One thing that I think is very much marked about the way things have developed today in both the sociology and the philosophy of science that is a product of pulling away from this sort of big normative conception of science is that the kinds of things that, let's say, philosophers in particular would have regarded as problems, like the problem of rationality, is now just treated as facts. Right? So in the past, one would worry about things like God, you know? Is physics a logically coherent theory? Is evolutionary theory a logically coherent theory with regard to all the biological data? I mean, these sorts of issues used to be argued about back in the days when physics was the primary example of science. And there were all these problems that had to do with logical consistency, had to do with whether one was living up to a certain standard. All these things were problems. How do you explain the fact that, you know, scientists don't catch on fast enough in history, you know, the Lakatosh problem? All of these things were seen as problems. But now we don't call them problems. We just call them, they're the facts. That's just the way science is. So science isn't about contradiction. You know, there isn't, these things that you call contradictions and incoherences is a failure for you to realize that scientists, right, are situated reasoners, right? And they're situated variously. And as their context changes, they adapt appropriately to those contexts. So what you're calling a contradiction is the failure to respect distinctions in context. Right, and this is the classic way in which things that in the past, with regard to the philosophy of science, were called problems that had to be addressed, right, are now just accepted as diversity. That's just the way things are. Live with it. Okay? And the presumption is that the norms that come internally from the actual practice of science in its multifarious forms is norms enough. It's normative enough. Okay? Now, this kind of view, it seems to me, is a somewhat dangerous view to hold unless one has a very kind of sophisticated sociology or social epistemology behind it. Because there's one context in which one can imagine this sort of view of as it were, turning problems into facts about science, where it could be acceptable, and that is if you imagine that, as it were, the people who you want to call scientists are in fact calling their own shots in some kind of straightforward, free way, where different disciplines are making sort of judgments within their own community, very much kind of on the model of a Kuhnian paradigm. If you recall the whole Kuhnian paradigm business, what gives science its focus is the fact that the research agenda is determined by the scientific community, which is self-constituting. And not surprisingly, Kuhn focused on sciences that didn't involve a lot of capital. So in other words, there are not a lot of other people to consult in order to determine where science should go, because basically science is about solving self-defined problems which you can solve with your own resources. Okay? And that then makes it a kind of self-propelling, self-defining kind of activity, which of course, once you get there's a crisis where you can't solve certain problems, you may force to branch out, right, where the incommensurabilities become sub-disciplines and you move, and that's kind of the Kuhn model. It makes good normative sense if the scientists are in fact calling their own shots and this process is in a sense, as Kuhn presents it, internally driven. Because then you can imagine just things kind of moving their own trajectory. But what if you think that in fact the way in which science is developing and has developed has in fact been caused by things not just involving the scientists, though the scientists are themselves involved, but lots of other things going on in the world, which the scientists in some way have to implicate their interests with. Okay? And that increasingly, as science becomes more expensive and has, as it were, more real-world implications, and has as a result to become more accountable to larger groups of people, there is more room for, as it were, the agendas to be taken in the various directions of the various parties affected. Okay? So you end up having a kind of natural history, you might say, that is more externally driven in that sense. And it seems to me that the normative, whatever normative dimension is left in the philosophy of science isn't sufficiently paying attention to this kind of issue. And as a result, there isn't really a kind of independent perspective from which philosophers can start to make judgments about whether science is kind of moving in the way it ought to be moving, right? Other than just look at what the scientists themselves are doing and what they agree to do, Okay? In order to do that, one has to do two things. One has to, first of all, acknowledge that science is being directed by many different kinds of forces, not just a scientist, but at the same time, one needs to have some kind of independent way of making a judgment about what is the right way, what is a better or worse way for science to go. In other words, the kinds of problems that were traditionally addressed by the problem, by the question of rationality and the question of progress and things of that kind. But nowadays, it seems to me, one can no longer take for granted that the ends of science are given. So this is no longer exclusively an issue about methodology. Okay, but it is also equally an issue about the ends. Where do we want it to go? How do we know if we've got there, if we've gotten there, and what would cause us to revise our viewpoint? Okay, and now in this book, book that I have finished and just published on Kuhn versus Popper, part of what I'm doing in that book is in a way recovering the Popperian position for this kind of view that I'm advocating now. Okay, that in a sense this was very much part of the Popperian and the positivistic perspective, namely trying to come up with a kind of independent way of judging what is good and bad in science, operating on the understanding that in fact we may be living in times when science isn't doing so hot just on its own accord, where in some sense it may be in captivity to various kinds of forces, and that we need some independent way of telling whether it is going well or going poorly. And it seems to me that even though we don't live in totalitarian times or anything like that, I'm not saying anything of that sort, we nevertheless do live in times where market models are incredibly attractive for all, not only at the substantive level, namely science ought to be funded through a market mechanism, but also as a way of modeling how science operates. And these have very interesting kinds of articulations with evolutionary models as well. And I think we have to be very careful about this. And it is not sufficient just to rely on a kind of naturalistic, you know, natural historical approach to knowledge in order to justify this. Because that is to take for granted that, in fact, the way science has developed is, in fact, normatively appropriate and desirable. And unless we're just going to make a sort of collapsing of the is into ought, this should still be a very serious problem for philosophers to deal with at the most general level in order to be brought back into the front line. Okay, in conclusion, what I'm complaining about is not just the sort of the division of disciplinary labor among the sciences and the disappearance of the concept of science as a normatively resonant notion, but I'm also complaining about the discipline, the division of labor within the discipline of philosophy, where there's a sense in which, in order to address adequately the kinds of questions that I've been raising, which I think come up quite naturally from the science wars, philosophy of science has to be taught and understood together with social and political philosophy, with other forms of epistemology, with ethics. In other words, we need to reunify philosophy in order to be able to get back to address these questions. And as long as philosophy remains this specialized discipline, getting increasingly specialized, and as it were, mimicking the developments in the sciences in that way, we're never going to be able to regain that kind of that perspective, which I think is the classical philosophical perspective and is the one that justifies the existence of philosophy as a discipline today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm going to start with Lorenzo, please. You could, then Joe. Would you? You, yes, yes, you. Yes. No. With the black jacket. I'm mispronouncing your name, perhaps.
Oh, fine. I agree with the call for a return to the normative. There seems to be, always have to be in a comparative way. That's to say, one can't come up with a yardstick for looking at a theory in isolation. It's always a matter of whether or not it's less interested in inconsistency, narrowness of scope, abundance of ad hoc assumptions, compared with some rival, looking at the same set of problems. But in that way, it seems to me, more of the questions can be raised in a plausible way. I just simply want to say, what ought to be doing this in comparison?
I agree. And in fact, one of the things that I argue in the Kuhn versus Popper book that in a sense gives you a flavor of what I'm talking about is that I actually believe there should be, as it were, elections between competing theories. Because, I mean, one of the things about the problem... No, because one of the problems... I mean, if you think about... The philosophy of science classically has been full of this kind of language of choice and decision and stuff like this with regard to theories. But we don't really push the kind of the whole political angle on this. We sort of imagine that the scientists in their sort of self-constituting way decide when to decide. right? In other words, unless they run across a problem, there's no, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? This seems to be always with a background assumption of a lot of this discussion about theory choice in the history of in the philosophy of science. Namely, you just take as given the points in history when scientists had some kind of debate about which way they should go. You just take that as normatively given, and then you figure out how they figured out which one to go to. But if you want a really robust normative perspective, you have to say, look, we can't wait till stuff just breaks itself down, right? It's just like in democratic politics in general. You have to, as it were, raise the invitation to think about where you want to go from here at regular intervals, because that then brings the question of ends more clearly into focus, right? Because if you've already got a dominant science that can call the shot whenever its decisions are taken, right, it's going to be pretty hard to replace that science unless you're doing pretty much what it was, what the old science is doing, and then add a little bit extra. I mean, this is kind of the thing philosophers are always telling you. But that's because, in a sense, the question of the ends of the science isn't really being problematized in any kind of serious way. To do that, you actually need a kind of formal mechanism that forces people to say, okay, we've been doing this kind of physics for 5 years. Where do we go from here? What are the alternatives? And as it were, invite alternatives, and then have elections as I'm using this as a metaphor here, but you get the idea, where there's a sense in which that the ends, the issue of the ends gets foregrounded when you're actually forcing people to make decisions on a regular basis. Yeah, sorry.
Hi, I'm Eric Sherry from UCLA. I'd like to make 3 short remarks, if I may, on each of the basic sciences. First, about chemistry. You actually singled out chemistry and said that in the Weimar period, chemistry came under a lot of criticism for things like poison gas, you didn't actually say.
Yeah.
And the logical positivists were motivated to somehow rehabilitate chemistry. It seems
not rehabilitate chemistry, I didn't say that.
Science. Okay, then maybe my question is slightly misplaced then. But it does seem odd, doesn't it, that chemistry got sidelined as a result of logical positivism, and it's taken a small group of us a lot of time to rehabilitate the philosophy of chemistry. And it's largely because the logical positivists convinced everybody that chemistry was subservient to physics.
Right. Well, let me
go on to the other.
Can I answer this and then we get to his next one?
No.
All right, because I don't want to lose these points here.
Second one about biology. You imply that modern biology has been carried out in a state of disunity as opposed to the old physics. I think that's a little bit exaggerated. Modern biology has been a very much a reductionist sort of science based on the structure of DNA. That's what's allowed reductionism to change its focus from physics to biology, if anything. Lastly, on physics, I think you vastly overemphasize this idea that physics is no longer the fundamental science. Just because Michael Friedman and Nancy Cartwright are writing historical accounts about...
The end is near.
If you ask any scientist about the position of physics, it is still the fundamental science. You can't just sort of wipe that away and say...
Okay. First of all, with regard to chemistry, there's a book, some of you may know who are familiar with the Weimar period, called Reactionary Modernism, okay, by Jeffrey Herf, came out about 20 years ago. And what it basically talks about is the kinds of sciences that were in fact favored in the Weimar Republic, almost all of which the logical positivists were against. And a certain kind of chemistry came back into fashion, actually, in the Weimar period, which was a kind of, you might say, cultural chemistry. You know, kind of folk chemistry, you might say, of that kind, and that was true also with engineering and some of the other more practice-based sciences, that they had a kind of revival in the Weimar period. But it seems to me that the positivists were complaining, first of all, about the way in which chemistry dragged all of science into the gutter with World War I. That's the first problem. But second of all, the way it was being revived in the Weimar period was very particularistic, nationalistic, and that was something else they were also very much against in terms of the idea of universality of science. So there's a kind of complicated story there about the politics of chemistry that needs to be told. With regard to reductionism in biology, I think what you say, this is the argument from Following the Money, because I think from the standpoint of where the money is gone, yes, reductionism perhaps has some something there. But look, if you look at all the disciplines that are normally called biological, you know, we have ecology, natural history, you know, we've got all loads of disciplines, right, which don't presuppose this kind of reductionist model, all right? I mean, and it's, in fact, I think that that has been something that the philosophy of biology sort of in the last 20 years has kind of really brought up to the forefront. So, and then with regard to physics, there's an interesting question here, right? Let's say we, certainly in the popular literature of science, there's still the belief that physics is the fundamental science, no doubt about it, okay? But I think there's a question now with regard to, which is similar to a lot of these other concepts that I said were kind of under erasure at the moment, is what does fundamental mean anymore, right? I mean, once you kind of no longer believe in the unity of sciences, once you no longer believe there's this kind of natural logical structure to the sciences, either between the sciences or inside the sciences, in a sense you can kind of conceive the word fundamental as a rhetorical token. It doesn't mean anything anymore. Well, fundamental to what exactly? And what's fundamental, you know, and so it seems to me that a lot of the precise logical technical meaning that had motivated a lot of projects has sort of disappeared, and it's become a kind of a rhetorical placeholder, especially if you're talking about the level at which you brought it up, which is if you ask scientists what they think, right, then sure, they're also going to say science is rational, but does rationality have any content here, right? Science is objective. Does that have any content here? And I think that's the kind of concern that I would have. So yeah, the words are still there, but they don't quite have the kind of meaning that they did before.
Okay, Joe, and then the fellow in the back, and then over here, and then...
Yeah, see, my question follows up on this, because it seems to me that, in fact, in a lot of places in contemporary work, there is exactly the kind of normative concern that you're interested in, focused upon, you know, where the university will be, how
yeah.
the curriculum will be structured,
yeah.
what are the important issues. But what is being recognized, once you get the the grand unificationist language out of the way, is that in fact these have always been intramural debates within the sciences with other connections coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And that, it's not that it's simply following the sciences, it's following issues in the sciences and bringing in a variety of resources. Just take one example. Ron is talking about Steven Weinberg's contributions to the science world. But of course, the things Weinberg is talking about are not just about science versus sociologists. It's a very bitter fight within physics, in which the kind of science and
he's talking about the super collider.
Yeah, so the debate with Philip Anderson, the debate with people like Eric Heller about what is physics really about here? Now, of course, that's all you've had that going on in biology as well. Look at what's happening with the rise of EcoDevo work. Which the philosophers have been and the sociologists have been coming into precisely on the question of not what is science aiming for, but what kind of questions should we be asking and why, and what kinds of resources are being brought in, and making much more specific and local arguments, but they're not anormative at all.
Well, what do you think the role of science is? What does the concept of science mean in this kind of new, kind of devolved normative environment that you're talking about?
The concept of science is plural. There are lots.
Yeah, but what does that mean?
No, what it means is that you do in fact have interacting families of disciplines that are contesting for the kind of authority you're talking about, which are getting various kinds of resources, connecting to a variety of problems, which depend upon particular conceptions of what we want to know, why we want to know it, what kinds of resources are there, and those battles are being fought not at a grand unified stage, but they're being fought more locally. But they're very much normative issues about what we want to know, why we want to know it, what kinds of resources we want to use, and what would be the outcome.
Well, see, I guess what I in Britain where I currently live, there's always a we're always restructuring universities, kind of the way in which people rearrange furniture. And one of the things that happens typically, right, is that you get issues about whether you want certain departments to continue surviving, right? And the thing that is very striking about the kind of academic culture in which we currently live is that, it's kind of like, as it were, every discipline for themselves. Right, so they all are trying to maintain their own kinds of advantage and so forth, but they don't really see themselves as part of any kind of common project anymore, right? So if push comes to shove, because physics departments are getting closed down a lot in the UK at the moment, because physics is seen as yesterday's science, and so the thing is that, you don't see a lot of biologists shedding tears over this, right, because they're often the main beneficiaries of the extra office space. and that, it seems to me, that indicates something, that is no longer, yes, I understand, of course, a lot of normative battles have to be fought in the local level, and they only make sense at the local level, but there is no longer a sense of common stake among all these different local battles.
Except, you rightly say, the university.
Yes, exactly. And look at, and this is the problem. This is where the issue of the integrity and autonomy of the university is the sort of thing that we, in fact, ought to be paying much more attention to and defending. Okay? Because we live in a period now where not only science, but knowledge is being pluralized, and it's happening everywhere. It almost seems to be happening everywhere but the university. Right? And so the, as it were, the distinctiveness of the university as a site of knowledge production, where all these disciplines somehow got together and focused on things like curriculum, right? That is really disappearing. It's seen as an old 19th century idea. And as long as you've got science parks competing with universities for research purposes, and you have these diploma mills going on competing for the curriculum, the whole integrity of the idea of there being a common site where we all have a common stake, that is fading from view. And maybe, I mean, it's happening much faster in Europe than it is in America, because America is still a very wealthy country, and there's still quite a lot going on here to protect academia, I think.
Does it happen inside the university?
Well, yeah.
For the sake of pluralism, yes, indeed, yourself. Yes.
Running back to the issue of the science wars, it seems to me that the science wars, in a way, represented something like what we start to suggest should happen, that is, some normative debate.
Yeah.
About
that's right. Yes.
Because if we're only stuck with objects and subjects, if we're relative and absolute, we're going to have these sort of stupid, crude debates. Do you have any thought about kind of trying to proliferate or enrich the evaluative vocabulary? That, and in a way, it could be used, as you sort of put it, for export, right?
Yes. Well, you know, the history of philosophy actually has the resources for this if philosophers of science and others concerned with this matter were to take it up. I mean, the whole discipline of axiology, which arose in the late 19th century, and there's a lot of very sophisticated discussion about evaluation and prescription and all these different kinds of normative stances one might have toward things and so forth. In fact, there was a time, around the time of the logical positivists, in fact, where there was this discussion of there being, you know, there were science of norms that would be kind of a meta-science for all of the normative disciplines, you know, philosophy of science, epistemology, ethics, aesthetics, right? I mean, just about all of them would come under this rubric. And it seems to me that the resources are actually there in the history of philosophy. It's just that, you know, the usable part of the history of philosophy for purposes of contemporary philosophy tends to be incredibly narrow, right? And so I do think that actually mining the history of philosophy for the discussion about values, about the value discussion, which tends to be very stereotyped, very stripped down, I think you'll find a lot of how to begin this anew. Okay, because, you know, if you go back, again, going back to the Weimar period where there was a lot of discussion about values too, right, this was in the climate of neo-Kantian philosophy where there was a recognition that there were all these different disciplines going on doing different things, and one has to think about how does one want to evaluate them? How do you know they're working well or poorly? That was already a going concern, right? And the logical positivists basically thought the neo-Kantians didn't make enough, make enough ground on this, didn't get far enough, they didn't think more radically enough about it. But it seems to me that there are precedents for this kind of discussion, and that's why going back to the Weimar period, you know, and before that, I think you could start to get those resources. So one doesn't have to, like, create stuff, you know, weird language that never existed in philosophy before.
This may come from my own kind of perspective and interest, but you talk about bringing in, Steve, a normative perspective, but it looks to me like there are very different normative questions. Let me just sort of point to two or three, because I do better if I make it concrete. Go back to the sort of genetic paradigm within philosophy of biology, within biology, right? So that is the focus on the genome. Look, the normative perspective there is brought up by Genentech and Biogen, right? This seriously changes the way you look at the program of research in the sequencing project. Can't just comment on, right, you can't just read James Watson and think you've got a good take on on genetics, right? That's one sort of case. The other sort of case is one of the ones you point to, that is the creationist intelligent design theories, right? those you get a very different kind of normative issue getting raised. So they all may have to do with the integrity of academia, right? There's a third kind of case that comes out of biology too, which is now a dispute within academia, which is a yet another kind of normative science. And that's when you get the conflicts between the people who do educational testing and people like Lewinton, who are worried about the interpretation of the work in the analysis of variance. There's another normative set range of issues, where philosophers have gotten, by the way, into all three of these issues, right? And in normative ways. But it doesn't strike me that there's a single kind of normative stance. I wonder if you've thought enough about what kinds of normative stances, the ranges of types there are.
Yeah.
That's really the request. And by the way, the postscript for Ron, you don't really want us to just do descriptive philosophy of science when we encounter things like Arthur Jensen or
No.
Well, no, I agree that these are three different kinds of normative tasks, and I'm supportive of all of them. I do think, though, there is a question about, well, what do they hang together, as it were, as part of a kind of common normative project for the philosophy of science?
Exactly my question.
Yeah. And I actually believe that if there is something called science that needs to be defended here in the science wars, you know, to go back to the topic of this thing, then there should be an answer to that, right? And it should be something more than just, as it were, the normative problems kind of arise internally to the particular nature of these three disputes that you're talking about. Because I think that would be quite a disappointing answer if it just turns out to be that. Right, we call these things normative, but what generates them is really something inside, right? As were internal conflicts of one kind or another.
Yeah.
But no, I see that as kind of the philosophical task, is to try to sort that out.
I was hoping you'd give us the answer.
Give you the answer. I do. In answer to the first question about the business about the science elections and things like this, I do think it would pay for us as philosophers of science to sort of think about this issue of making decisions between different things, trying to institutionalize that in a kind of way. And how should one make decisions about, let's say, whether we should teach creationism or evolutionary biology or some combination or something like that, and try to, as it were, come up with a procedural framework. You know, so in other words, an institutional version, in a sociologically informed institutional version of the kind of thing I think people were trying to get at in the old days. I think that's really what's important now.
I love your talk. I love each part of it. I'm just trying to understand how it all fits together.
Me too. No.
You take us to the history, and you kind of talk about the old days and the holistic view of philosophy and science and how all this is now only for undergraduates and so the package for export. So that's old days. And then you talked about the new, the science war somehow dissolved. I mean, here, at least as far as the philosophers versus sociologists, and we're all on the same side. We're all doing this, our contextualized and specific localized inquiries. And so the other stuff, you know, is dead, and it's for undergraduates only. And so you said, and you seem to say, yes, and this is the way to go, of course. And we can't talk about science anymore, because we can't talk about philosophy of science anymore. And then you seem to be rebelling against that and saying, no, we need a new philosophy of science, but it sounded more like the stuff that was packaged for the undergraduates, because we want these holistic, we want a normative, but we want, now you said very briefly, I personally applaud very much, and he said, we want to infuse a normative with a political as well.
Yeah.
So you had that going, but I don't understand how what you're coming out with at the end. Now, Joe Rouse said, for example, well, your normative can be infused with the political as well as the epistemic, but it's local and it's specialized and it's splintered, and so you can't get this big holistic thing. And you kind of nodded your response to that. I don't know exactly what you're ending up with. I mean, I have a hope for something, you know, philosophy of science still on the scene in this. Yeah, I don't know how, you know, in the old-fashioned way, in a sense. I wouldn't
Okay, look, just to recover, as it were, what the structure of the talk was, it's sort of a dialectical structure, you might say, right? In the beginning, we had this kind of primordial holism or something in the philosophy of science, the unity stuff, and then what I do is I sort of take us through how it's all fallen apart a lot more than we perhaps realize, and how it's how that falling apart has become normalized, so that all of these concepts like science and rationality and so forth don't quite mean very much anymore, except in very localized, particularized ways, and that this is in fact common to the philosophers and sociologists, you know, who are supposedly fighting a science war, but in fact agree a lot more than we realize. So the question is this a good or bad thing? And my view is, you know, at this stage of the game, given where we are in history, it's turning out to be a bad thing, and that we need to recover some of that stuff that was lost. So that's kind of what the dialectic of the talk is. Now, with regard to the made-for-export undergraduate stuff, I know that sounds like a disparaging way of referring to it, of course, but in a sense, I should re-spin that, because I'm trying to say that that's in fact where the action is, that's where it matters, and in the sense that the authority, science is a kind of normative authority, where that matters the most isn't in terms of, you know, helping scientists do their work better or something like that, but in terms of general public understanding and their attitudes toward science and the society at large, and that is something that's imparted in the undergraduate courses. So there's a sense in which that seems to be the most valuable context in which this general kind of philosophy of science can be taught, and it is a needed context, but it needs to be revitalized.
So what does that mean? What are philosophers of science supposed to be doing then? You really now, you've disparaged the current stuff as well as the old stuff.
I know. Well, you know.
Wait,
I know, look, I mean, there's nothing wrong with criticism in this world, okay? I'm surprised I have to say this to philosophers. I mean, the point is you really have to kind of see just how bad things are before you can, get resurrected. But I do think that there is a way back, and I think it does involve taking the idea of the curriculum more seriously. Why do you want people who aren't going to be trained as scientists or professional philosophers of science, for that matter, to learn something about the philosophy of science? Why make that part of general education? Because that is, in fact, what that old stuff did. Okay, and it seems to me that that's the issue that needs to be reintroduced and rethought, but shouldn't just disappear or wither away the way it's currently happening now.
We have technically no more time.
Sorry.
And I'm going to take one question. Oh. And other people who have no watches can stay. Yes.
Yes, no, that's a very good point, and I am in sympathy with what you're saying. I recognize the tension, and I am in sympathy with a kind of, you might say, science for the people. The problem is, how do the people need to be organized in order for this science to actually bring about the autonomy and integrity and all the rest of it? And that's, in a way, sort of the problem of socialism, right? That was the old problem of socialism, right? It's one thing to say, okay, you know, we want the people to be able to rule themselves and so forth, but a crucial step along the way is to figure out what is the appropriate form of organization and institutionalization to enable this to happen, so they don't just fall into another trap, right? And I think that is exactly the kind of problem that we're talking about here. But, you know, no matter how individualistic or autonomous one wants to talk about people or the university, there's always been a need for a certain kind of institutional structure to be in place. You know, so for example, tenure, right, as a kind of prod for people to be saying things that, you know, they would otherwise not have the license or at least be worried about they might get fired for saying, right? Those kinds of institutional things that in a way are kind of losing their salience these days are things that in a way need to be revived, maybe reinvented in a new form. So I'm not like saying we ought to go back to 1800, but I do think it's time to kind of, you know, as it were, reinvent in new guise, in an appropriate guise that takes into effect all of the bitter history that we've gone through and all the problems that there have been, the false hopes and so forth in the past. But we shouldn't just give up the project, okay? And I think at the moment we are getting to a situation where the idea of the university as an institution, right, is beginning to fade, right? And I think that's a really, really bad sign. And so, but that doesn't mean we have to go back to von Humboldt directly, right? We have to just think for the future, but recover what's valuable about the past.
Given where most of us work. I would like to thank both of our speakers, Professor Geary and Professor Fuller, and to thank you also for your interventions and for your